The candles toppled over, and the glass bell globe shattered on the hard earth. The legless spirit baby flopped upside down from its wooden attachment beneath the table, its stuffed arms hanging limp next to its yarn-covered head. Pierre stomped on the candles to put them out, and Merrick threw his arms around John's shoulders. Nearly twice his size, John tore Merrick off his back, pushed him to the ground, and punched him in the face. Then he got up and tore down the curtains and stars and mirrors. Merrick groaned and rolled over on his side. "Stop!" Lily said. "Please, John, stop!" John bellowed like a madman and ripped down one of the side walls, nearly bringing the entire roof down with it. Then he wrenched down the wall, facing the midway, revealing the interior of the tent to the line of waiting rubes. Women gasped and stepped back, and men moved forward to protect them. John gaped at the crowd, his eyes wild, pieces of canvas and ripped curtains in his hands. "They're stealing your money," he yelled. "It's all fake!" Mouths dropped open in confusion and shock. Faces contorted in anger. Several men shook their fists and demanded a refund, while others grumbled amongst themselves. Merrick struggled to his feet and held up his hands. "Now, now," he said, blood gushing from his nostrils. "Can't you see this man is intoxicated? And at a family gathering, no less. He doesn't know what he's saying." "Then why are you asking for names before we go in?" a young woman called out.
"Yeah," a man yelled. "What's that for?"
"That's for a money-back guarantee, just like we told you," Merrick said. He pointed at Alana, who stood between the tent and the rubes, her notebook clasped to her chest, her slack face the color of ash.
"She's the only one who sees the names until the end of the day. We're also keeping track of every spirit the albino medium contacts because we're trying to break the world record. And when you find people read about that in the papers, you'll know you and your loved ones had a hand in making it happen. Your family will be famous."
"Hogwash!" a man shouted.
"You're lying!"
someone else shouted.
"Damn right he's lying!"
John shouted. He trudged over to the wardrobe and yanked out the stuffed glove.
"See this? This is what that midget touches you with, all the while the albino's telling you you're feeling a ghost."
He yanked out the harmonica and bell and tambourine and threw them on the ground.
"See? It's all rigged."
With that, Merrick lunged at John like a battering ram and shoved him backward into the broken wardrobe. John collapsed in a heap of arms and legs and splintered wood. The rubes closed in to get a better view of the action, gawking and standing on their tiptoes to see over one another's shoulders and heads. Several men stepped forward, their chins raised, their hands and fists. Lily moved away from them, her breath coming shallow and fast. She wanted to run, but there was nowhere to go. She, Merrick, Alana, and Pierre were surrounded. John shook his head, then clambered out of the smashed wardrobe and staggered to his feet.
"You sons of bitches!" one of the rubes shouted. "I want my money back!"
"Me too!"
a woman yelled. This brought more angry shouts from the crowd. Finally, Mr. Barlow's patches pushed their way through the gathering and stormed toward the tent. Patches normally calmed unhappy customers by offering free tickets to the big show, or, if the problem rube was male, giving them a free pass to the special event in the back lot behind the baggage wagons, which was accessible only by word of mouth. But once in a while, they had to use force. This was one of those times. At first, John thought the patches were angry rubes, coming forward to back him up. Then they charged him, and his eyes went wide, looking around frantically for an escape route. Before he had a chance to run, one of the patches grabbed his wrist, twisted it behind his back, wrapped a muscular arm around his neck, and dragged him away from the now leaning tent. John sputtered and clawed at the patch's arm, but couldn't get away. The other patch stood between Lily and the crowd, with his arms crossed, daring the rubes to try something. Merrick raised his hands again and spoke to the irritated mob.
"Okay, folks, okay, everything's fine. The heckler has been removed from the area. If you've already paid to see the albino medium, we'll give you a full refund. She won't be doing any more readings this afternoon. Everyone else, it's time to move along. There's nothing more to see here."
The rubes, who already paid, grumbled and moved toward Alana, shoving and pushing to get in line for their refunds. The rest were reluctant to leave, afraid they might miss something. Merrick waved them away.
"Go on now," he said. "Move along."
Mr. Barlow pushed his way through the stragglers.
"What the hell is going on over here?"
he asked Merrick. Merrick turned his back to the rubes and kept his voice low. "Someone outed her. The rubes heard everything."
"Jesus Christ," Mr. Barlow said. "What did she do now?"
"I didn't do anything," Lily said. "That rube had his mind made up before he came into my tent."
"His mind made up about what?" Mr. Barlow said.
"Me being a fraud," Lily said.
Several women in the refund line heard what Lily said and gasped, then turned to spread the word, whispering behind their hands.
"Shut up, you dumb bitch," Merrick hissed at Lily.
"I don't care," she said. "I don't want to lie to people anymore. I can't."
"I don't give a damn what you want," Merrick said. "You do what I tell you to do. Without me, you'd still be locked in your parents' attic, half out of your mind. I saved your sorry ass, and I own you."
He glared at her, daring her to speak. She said nothing. There was no point. He dismissed her with a wave of his hand.
"Go back to the train and stay there. After we fix the tent, you're on again."
Mr. Barlow scanned the collection of angry rubes, his brow creased.
"It's too late for that," he said. "Word is out she's a gaffe, and it'll spread like wildfire. Once the cops hear about it, we'll get heat for sure."
He cursed under his breath and balled his hands into fists.
"And at our biggest venue,"
he pointed a finger at Merrick, anger flickering in his eyes.
"Come up with a new act for her. In the meantime, she can recoup your losses by working for Josephine in the Cooch Show."
Chapter 20. Julia. 2 days after the ice storm and Fletcher's surprise visit, the weather warmed and everything began to thaw. Water dripped into the already soaked ground, and snow and ice fell off roofs and buildings in giant wet chunks. Tube-shaped pieces dropped from branches and wires, and dark patches of green grass and wet stone became visible beneath fields of translucent ice. The power came back on, and the furnace sprang to life in the basement of Blackwood Manor. The house ticked as it began to warm. Julia wrapped a sweater around herself and watched the wet scene from the kitchen window, sipping a cup of hot tea and honey. Over at the barn, a truck and horse trailer backed into the driveway. At first, she thought it was Fletcher's truck, but a man she'd never seen before got out and went into the office. Fletcher had stopped in the previous day to check the pipes like he said he would, but he only stayed a few minutes. A client was waiting at another farm, and he couldn't be late. He was polite, but businesslike, and Julia didn't know what to say other than thank you. She thought about apologizing, but for what, she wasn't sure. For their awkward exchange? For asking him to leave so quickly? For sending him out on the ice-covered roads after he'd been kind enough to check in on her? He was the one who made the decision to venture out to Blackwood Manor on such a treacherous night. She hadn't asked him to come, and it wasn't her job to keep him safe. Besides, even if she had wanted him to stay, for safety reasons or otherwise, the last thing she needed was for Claude to think something was going on between them. Still, she hated the thought of him being mad at her.
Over at the barn, the man got back in his truck, backed the trailer up to the main door, got out, and went into the office again. Julia furrowed her brow. What was going on? Claude hadn't said anything about a new horse being delivered, or any of them being sold. And he wouldn't make those decisions without asking her anyway. Would he? She stared out the window, paralyzed by indecision. She didn't know whether to go over there and ask, or wait and see what happened. Then, before she could make up her mind, the man got in his truck and drove away, and Claude let some of the horses out in the main paddock. The horses ran and kicked and rolled in the snow, enjoying their freedom after being stuck in the barn during the storm. Bonnie Blue raced out of the barn and galloped around the perimeter of the fence, her head held high, her nostrils flaring. She looked desperate, whinnying and calling out, waiting for someone to answer. Julia's heart dropped. Where was Samantha? She set her cup down on the counter so hard it nearly cracked, then hurried into the mudroom, threw on boots and a jacket, and flew out the door. If something had happened to Samantha, she wasn't sure she could handle it. She rushed across the yard, sidestepping icy patches and puddles, until she reached the barn, then yanked open the office door. She ran through the office and burst into the center aisle, searching frantically for Claude. He was putting straw in one of the stalls.
"Where's Samantha?"
she said, her voice rattled by fear. "I saw Blue outside alone, and she's beside herself." Claude stopped spreading the straw and looked at her, confusion written on his face.
"She's with a nurse mare."
"Why?" Julia said. "Blue is frantic." Her racing heart slowed, but only a little. Claude gave her a stern look, as if she should know the answer.
"Blue is one of our top producers. We need to breed her again as soon as possible."
"What does that have to do with taking Samantha away from her?"
"We need Samantha to stop nursing, so Blue will go into heat again."
"But Samantha is only 3 days old. She's too young to be taken from her mother."
Claude shrugged. "That's the way it's done. Blue will get over it. She always does."
A surge of sorrow and anger welled up in Julia's chest. She knew hard decisions sometimes had to be made when working with animals, but taking a 3-day-old foal away from its mother was ridiculous and cruel. For the first time in her life, she was so mad she didn't care what Claude or anyone else thought. The horses belonged to her now, and she had pledged to take care of them.
"Where is she?"
she asked again. He lifted his chin, indicating the other end of the barn.
"In with a nurse mare who delivered last night."
"What's a nurse mare? Explain it to me like I'm in first grade."
Irritation furrowed Claude's brow.
"A nurse mare is a horse who just foaled and is able to produce milk. We use nurse mares to nurse other foals, foals that might be worth money. Like Blue's filly, Samantha."
"So the nurse mare is taking care of 2 babies?
"No, just Blue's."
Julia frowned.
"What about the nurse mare's foal? Where is it?"
Claude went back to spreading straw.
"Where is it? Tell me."
He looked at her, his face flat.
"We send nurse mare foals to auction."
"Is that what that truck was doing here? Picking up the nurse mare's foal?"
Claude nodded.
"So you took Blue's 3-day-old filly away from her and gave it to the nurse mare, then took the nurse mare's newborn away from her and sent it to auction?"
He took off his gloves and fixed hard eyes on her.
"The sooner you learn that nurse mare foals are byproducts of the racing industry and the pharmaceutical industry, the better off you'll be. Some farms let nurse mare foals starve, club them to death, or sell them for skin and meat. We don't do that here."
"Well, how do you know the foal won't be sold for skin and meat at the auction?"
"I don't."
Julia bunched her hands into fists at her sides.
"Go get it."
He gaped at her.
"Beg your pardon?"
"I want you to put Samantha back in Blue's stall with her. Then I want you to go get the nurse mare's foal and bring it back here.
Claude sighed loudly and shook his head.
Sorry, but that's not how it's done, Miss Blackwood. This is a business, not a place for bleeding hearts.
Well, I own this business now, and we're doing things my way. No more taking foals away from their mothers, and no more sending newborns to auction.
Claude straightened his shoulders and jutted out his chin.
We're trying to make money here. We raise racehorses and show horses, not barnyard pets.
I don't care. I've seen the books, and we've got plenty of money. And while I'm in charge, we're not taking babies from their mothers. We'll have to figure out another way to make things work.
Just then, Fletcher came into the barn.
What's going on?
Claude came out of the stall and yanked off his gloves.
Ask her,
he said, and stormed away. He exited through the open barn door, got in his truck, slammed the driver's side door, and sped out of the driveway, gravel shooting from his back tires.
Fletcher looked at Julia, eyebrows raised. Where's he going in such a hurry?
Despite her conviction that she was doing the right thing, she was on the verge of tears. Her knees shook as adrenaline left her body. Putting her foot down and saying what she thought was exhausting.
To get the nurse mare's foal and bring it back here.
What? Why?
I don't want foals taken from mares or sent to auction, she said. Ever.
Fletcher crossed his arms and leaned against the wall, his face somber.
Okay, but that means more time between births and fewer horses to sell.
I don't care. Blackwood Farm is doing perfectly fine, and if we have to get by on less in the future, we'll figure that out when the time comes. But I refuse to make money that way. Now, will you please help me give Samantha back to Bonnie Blue?
He put on a pair of gloves and studied her, the hint of a grin on his face.
Yes, Miss Blackwood.
She turned and started down the aisle in the other direction.
Hey, where are you going?
He said.
I thought you wanted help taking Samantha to Blue.
You can do it, she called over her shoulder. Their stall needs to be cleaned.
She entered Blue's stall and got to work.
In truth, she needed to be alone. The thought of the foals being taken away from their mothers, ripped without warning from everything familiar and loved, then starved, clubbed, or sold for meat, tore her heart to shreds. Tears filled her eyes as she imagined Blue and the nurse mare, scared and confused and frantic, wondering why someone had taken their babies. She could almost feel the horrible heavy pain in their chests, the terror and helplessness in their minds. It didn't matter that they were animals. Mares still possessed the maternal instinct. She had seen it with her own eyes when Bonnie Blue looked back at her newborn filly. It was love at first sight. Her mother had never looked at her that way, but Julia had studied enough interactions between mothers and daughters to recognize unconditional love when she saw it. Then another thought hit her, and she had to stop working. How many foals had been taken away from their mothers at Blackwood Manor Horse Farm? How many horses' hearts had been broken because of her parents' greed? How could anyone be that callous year after year after year? What kind of people were her parents anyway?
Chapter 21. Lily. Wearing a white silk gown, kitten heels, satin evening gloves, and a white feather boa, Lily shivered in front of a cracked mirror in the Cooch Show dressing tent. Despite the fact that it was well over 90 degrees outside, and the inside of the tent felt hotter still. She hadn't eaten a thing all day, and her empty stomach twisted with nerves and bile. Behind her, half-naked women wiped red lipstick off their lips, scrubbed beauty marks from their cheeks, and peeled tassels off their nipples. They were done for the night, and now it was time for the final Cooch Show act, Lily Blackwood. It was all she could do not to throw up. Earlier, Josephine had insisted Rosie and Ruby add color to Lily's face.
so Ruby drew a beauty mark above Lily's mouth, while Rosie lined her eyes with black liner and applied fake lashes.
"What did Cole say about Mr. Barlow putting you in the cooch show?" Ruby said.
She patted a makeup brush into a pot of rouge and brushed it over Lily's cheeks.
"He punched a hole in the wall of a boxcar and nearly broke his hand," Lily said.
"Oh, God," Ruby said. "Did you tell him it was only until Merrick comes up with a new act for you?"
Lily nodded, a burning lump growing in her throat. She had tried to tell Cole that no matter who saw her naked, she was still the same girl who came to him in the menagerie at night. She was still the same girl who snuck into his sleeper car when no one was looking, and followed him into the fields to make love beneath the stars. It was hard enough knowing she was being forced to appear naked on stage, but the thought of losing Cole was more than her heart could bear. He wasn't a prude by any means, but what would he think of her after she revealed herself to the world?
"And?" Rosie said. "What did he say?"
Lily's eyes filled.
"He said he needed some time alone and walked away."
"Jeepers," Ruby said.
She dabbed a tissue in the corner of Lily's eyes to stop her makeup from running.
"Well, he can't be mad at you for it."
Lily shrugged.
"You know,"
Rosie said, applying lipstick to Lily's lips,
"some men find it exciting to think about other men ogling their woman's body."
She winked playfully and grinned.
"Yeah," Ruby said. "For some reason, the thought of dating a cooch show girl gets their engines running. In case you hadn't noticed, practically all the single men in this dog and pony show are after us."
"That's right," Rosie said. "And some of the not-so-single ones, too."
The twins giggled. Lily loved them for trying to make her feel better, but it didn't work.
"I only want one."
Ruby grabbed another tissue.
"Aw, don't cry, sweetie. He'll come around."
When the twins were done putting on the makeup, Lily thought she looked like a clown. But she didn't have the heart to tell them that. Besides, she didn't care. Maybe the audience would think she looked like a clown, too, and her career in the girly show would be over before it began. Now, her mind raced as she sat in front of the mirror, trying to figure out how she could sabotage her act without getting caught. Nothing came to her. She was supposed to be over in the cooch show tent already, waiting in the wings. She got up and pulled back the dressing tent door to peer out. Maybe she could make a run for it. But one of Mr. Barlow's strongmen kept guard outside, protecting the girls and watching for rubes trying to sneak a free peek beneath the canvas walls. Across the narrow passageway, the cooch show tent glowed red, and Ruby's and Rosie's silhouettes danced and wiggled across the stage. Snare drums and a trumpet played sexy music, and men hooped and hollered for the twins to take it all off. The longer the music went on, the rowdier the men got.
"You ready?"
the strong man said to Lily. She steeled herself and stepped out of the changing tent, her limbs trembling. The strong man led her over to the back of the cooch show tent and pushed aside the entry flap. She swallowed the acid in her throat, went inside, and followed a short, dim corridor to the wings of the stage, where three overturned crates, two with cushions and one topped with ashtrays, glasses, and bottles of liquor, sat against the back wall. Watching from behind the curtains, her face grew hot as the twins shimmied across the pockmarked platform in G-strings and lace brassieres, a string of red lights illuminating their rouged faces. Like everything else they did, they moved and danced in perfect unison. Then they stopped and leaned forward, shaking their shoulders and covering their breasts with their hands. The men hollered and groaned.
"Show us what you got!"
a man yelled. The twins straightened, pouted coyly, and shook their index fingers back and forth. Then the snare drum rolled, and the twins faced each other and slid each other's bra straps down from their shoulders. They winked at the audience, rotated on their tiptoes, bent over again, and let their breasts swell forward in the loose cups of their brassieres.
"Come on!" another man shouted. "I paid good money for this!"
The twins shrugged, turned away from the audience, and reached behind their backs to undo their bra clasps. In perfectly timed identical movements, they glanced over their shoulders, winked again, and let their brassieres fall to the floor.
"That's it!" someone shouted. "There you go, girls! Turn around, honey!"
The twins spun around with their hands over their nipples, opened their red-lipped mouths in mock surprise, and took their hands away, letting their breasts drop. The men whooped in delight.
"Lord have mercy! Sweet Jesus!"
The twins did another quick little dance, then curtsied and ran off the stage, smiling and blowing kisses to the audience. The men cheered and whistled and clapped. Lily's neck and chest ignited with a strange mixture of shame and panic. She was next, and she didn't think she could go through with it. On the opposite side of the stage, Josephine sauntered out from behind the curtain and asked for a big hand for Rosie and Ruby. The men hollered and applauded. The twins hurried down the stage steps, entered the wing, and stopped beside Lily, laughing and out of breath.
"You look gorgeous," Ruby said. "Like a movie star," Rosie said.
"I think I'm going to be sick," Lily said. She was starting to feel dizzy.
On stage, Josephine raised a hand to quiet the men.
"It's your lucky night, fellas," she said, "because we've saved the best for last. Tonight, you're going to see something you'll never forget. Something so shocking, you'll be talking about it for weeks. This one is so special, boys, we're asking you to pay another quarter to stay. I can't say any more than it's our last girl of the evening, and you won't want to miss her. Just hand your quarter to that fella right there, and he'll let you stay for this final act. That's it. Just one more quarter, and you'll see something you'll be talking about for the rest of your lives."
"Listen," Rosie said to Lily. "The first time's the hardest, but once you see those men turn into little boys at your feet, you might like it."
"I doubt it," Lily said.
"Just remember what we taught you," Rosie said. "Start with a slow, sexy strut and make sure you smile. And play with your hair a little," Ruby said.
Lily nodded, suddenly incapable of speech.
"And now," Josephine announced to the audience, "our very own, the beautiful, the alluring, the angelic, the virginal, Miss Lily Blackwood."
Lily stood frozen, unable to put one foot in front of the other. Her heartbeat thundered in her ears, blocking out all sound. Josephine grinned like a wolf, one arm outstretched, and waited for her to come up the steps. Lily's vision started to close in, and the ground swayed beneath her feet.
"Go on, Lily," Ruby said. "You can do it."
"Quick," Rosie said. "Give her a swig before she runs."
Ruby grabbed a bottle of whiskey from the overturned crate, and before Lily could protest, held it to her lips and told her to drink. Lily took a big sip. The alcohol burned her throat and ignited her chest, but she didn't care. If it helped her get through this, she'd drink the entire bottle. She took several more good swallows, then pushed it away and coughed. She'd had her share of booze over the years, but never on an empty stomach, and she could already feel it slithering through her veins, warming her arms and legs.
"There you go," Ruby said. "That'll take the edge off. Now go on."
I can't, Lily stammered. "I can't do it."
"You have to," Rosie said. "You know what Merrick will do if you don't." "Come on," Ruby said. "Show him you're stronger than that."
For a second, Lily thought about taking the beating. Anything would be better than undressing in front of a crowd of drunken men. Then she remembered what Merrick said about entertaining rubes in a tent behind the baggage wagons, and something shifted in her head, like reason and logic and sanity coming unfastened deep within her. She felt it in her chest, too, like a loosening of her lungs and heart. Her breath felt bottomless. She wasn't sure if it was the whiskey or a sudden case of indifference, but something pushed her toward the stage. She almost laughed, wondering what the men's reactions would be when they saw the color of her skin. Maybe they'd go running out of the tent and spread the word that the Barlow brothers had a disgusting freak in their girly show. Maybe it would be the last time she'd have to do this. Holding up the hem of her silk evening gown, she marched up the steps on unsteady legs. Josephine winked at her and left the stage. When the music started, Lily took a deep breath and stepped into the spotlight. A collective intake of breath filled the tent, and there was a moment of awed silence. Standing men sat down hard in their chairs, and sitting men stood, wide-eyed and gawking. Lily was right. The Rubes didn't want to pay good money to see a freak take off her clothes. They wanted busty blondes, salty redheads, and voluptuous brunettes, not a ghost with a head full of spiderweb hair. Relief washed through her. There was no need to get naked after all. Then the men started whistling and clapping, and Lily's heart sank. She glanced nervously at Ruby and Rosie, who were watching from the wings. Ruby smiled and made a circular motion with her finger. Lily turned around, her back to the audience, and tried pulling herself together, a bulge of terror rising in her mind. Merrick and Mr. Barlow had forced her up there in front of a group of men who might be fearful of her, up there in front of men who might want to hurt her as badly as they wanted to see her naked. And now she was supposed to undress and put herself on display for them? It'd been years since Mama's words rang in her ears, but she could hear them now, like a returning nightmare from her youth, calling her an abomination and telling her it was a grievous sin to expose her naked body to anyone, even herself. And suddenly it broke. The horrible realization that she had been cheated out of a normal life came over her, and a soundless cry tore from her chest. Her only thought was to run, to get off the stage and get out of the tent. All at once, the whiskey rebelled inside her empty stomach, and she knew she was going to be sick. She turned and her feet tangled in her dress, and she almost fell. Then she recovered and headed toward the steps, a hand over her mouth. Someone in the audience began to laugh, and another man joined in. Others shouted angry words.
"Is this some kind of joke? Get that freak off the stage! We want our money back!"
An empty popcorn box hit Lily in the head. She hunched her shoulders and put her arm up to protect herself until she reached the stage steps and scrambled down them. At the bottom, she fell on her hands and knees and vomited in the flattened grass, her hair hanging in her eyes.
"Oh my God," Ruby said.
Rosie knelt beside her.
"Are you okay?"
The twins helped her up, and Josephine rushed back on stage to calm the angry crowd. Dizzy and disoriented, Lily broke free from the twins and stumbled along the wing. She went out the back flap and hurried into the dressing tent. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she heard Josephine calling the twins back up on stage. Trembling and trying to catch her breath, she collapsed inside the dressing tent. After a long minute, she got up, trudged over to a mirror, and wiped the red lipstick from her mouth with shaking hands. Using more force than necessary, she scrubbed the melted mascara from her eyes and cheeks. She'd done a lot of things to survive over the past 6 years, but she refused to take her clothes off in front of a room full of men. She just couldn't. And if Merrick and Mr. Barlow thought they could force her to entertain Rubes in the tent behind the baggage wagons, she'd run away. There was no other choice. She'd take her chances in the real world, or join a different circus. Maybe, if she begged him, Cole would leave with her. Behind her in the mirror, the canvas flap whipped open and Merrick stormed into the tent. She got off the stool and backed away. No matter what happened next, her conscience was clear.
"Who the hell do you think you are?"
Merrick shouted, his face snarling and red.
"You think you can just do whatever you want around here?"
"I was sick," she said. "The twins gave me whiskey and I
don't give a shit if you were dying. You made a laughingstock out of Josephine and the entire Barlow Brothers circus."
He launched forward and grabbed her arm.
"I warned you what would happen if you didn't do what you were told. Now you're going to be behind the baggage wagons with the rest of the whores."
"No," she said. "You can't make me. I won't do it." He bared his teeth and dragged her toward the rear of the tent.
"You will, and I'm going to be the one to break you in."
He shoved her behind a stack of steamer trunks, then seized her again, lifted her off her feet, and crushed her to his chest. Her kitten heels fell off, and for a moment she hung suspended, her bare toes scraping the tops of his boots. He shook her hard and set her down. When her feet touched the grass, she tried to get away, but he grasped her face, turned it toward his, and pushed his wet mouth over hers. She clamped her lips shut and tried to wrench free, but he wrapped his arms around her and held on tighter. The sour tang of whiskey and tooth decay filled her nostrils and mouth. She twisted and turned and kneed him in the crotch. He groaned in pain and loosened his grip, then slapped her across the face and shoved her backward with an angry grunt. She landed hard on her back and scrambled to her knees, trying to crawl away. But before she could get her feet beneath her and run, he grabbed her ankles, dragged her backward, flipped her over, and held her down.
"Let me go!"
she screamed, pushing against his chest. She swung at his head, her small fists colliding with his rock-hard jaw, his muscular neck, his granite temples. He grabbed her flailing arms with one rough hand and pinned them above her head, his face red with exertion. She bucked and twisted and tried to bring her knee into his crotch again, but couldn't lift her legs beneath him. He ripped open the front of the silk gown as if it were paper and tore off her underwear. Then he undid his pants and forced himself between her legs.
"You don't tell me what to do," he said. "I tell you. You belong to me, remember?"
She thrashed beneath him, using every ounce of strength she had to try and push him off. But it was no use. His full weight, nearly twice hers, pinned her to the ground like a moth beneath a rock. She could barely breathe. She turned her head and closed her eyes, then felt herself going somewhere else, like a dropped coin spiraling to the bottom of a lake. Away from this, away from him, away from what he was doing to her. She saw a black hole and felt herself falling in. Deep in the center of her soul, a diminutive, secret place split wide open. It was the only part of her she'd managed to keep hidden and protected. Even while people stared and made fun of her in the freak show. Now, without any warning, it was exposed and vulnerable, lingering for just a moment, like a trailing wisp of black smoke, and then it was gone. She let out a high, keen shriek, like the long final wail of a dying animal, until she tasted blood at the back of her throat. Suddenly, Merrick stopped and stared down at her, as if he had no idea who she was, his shocked face that of a man suddenly exorcised of a demon. Then, with a hard, low grunt of surprise and pain, his head jerked to the left and he fell to one side, his body limp. Behind him, Cole stood with a bull hook in his hands, his face contorted with rage. He dropped the bull hook and knelt beside her.
"Are you all right?"
he said. Lily gathered her torn gown over her trembling legs, rolled on her side, and curled into a fetal position, fighting the urge to jump up, grab the bull hook, and bash in Merrick's head. The newly dead space at the center of her soul began to shift and change. Then it shriveled, closed, hardened, and turned to stone. Cole scooped her off the ground and carried her out of the tent.
"You're going to be okay," he said. "I've got you."
She leaned against his shoulder and closed her eyes, her teeth chattering. He kissed the top of her head.
"I'm so sorry, Lily. I never should have let you go through with it. I should have protected you."
His voice sounded strangled, as if he had to force the words out.
"I hope I killed the bastard."
She looked up at him.
"No, don't say that. Mr. Barlow will have you red-lighted."
"I don't care." Neither of them spoke again as he carried her through the back lot. Above the ghostly roofline of the big top, above the yellow and orange flags and colored lights, a smattering of stars twinkled in the evening sky. The circus was starting to close down, and the jovial finale music floated out into the night. Laughter and shouts sounded in the distance as the Rubes started toward the exit, happily making last-minute stops at the sideshows and concession stands before returning to the normal world. When Cole and Lily reached the train, he passed her car and kept going.
"Where are you taking me?" she said.
"You're staying with me from now on. You're done with Merrick and that damn sideshow." Chapter 22. Julia. After Julia told Claude and Fletcher no more foals would be taken from their mothers at Blackwood Manor Horse Farm, she took a glass of brandy into her father's den to resume her search for the missing key and clues about her dead sister. She wiped the dust off the record player, turned it on, and put the needle at the beginning of Little White Lies. When the tinny, old-timey music filled the room, she stood there, frozen. Suddenly, she was a little girl again, hearing her father's curses and cries between the lyrics, mother's voice telling her to get away from the den doors. She knew if she turned around, she would see her father at his desk, his hand wrapped around a whiskey-filled tumbler, his dark-ringed eyes wet with tears. She switched off the record player, took a swig of brandy, and turned around. The desk chair was empty. After another long sip of brandy, she sat at the desk and ran her fingers beneath the middle drawer to see if the key was taped to the wood. It wasn't. She got on her hands and knees and looked beneath the desk. Cobwebs hung from the wooden legs, and dust bunnies tumbled away from her breath. There was no key. She reached into dusty vases and searched beneath anniversary clocks and trophies. She took horse pictures and certificates down from the walls and looked behind the frames. She rolled up the edges of the rugs, lifted lamps, felt below windowsills, and tested floorboards to see if any were loose. Nothing. Feeling defeated, she sat back down at the desk and tried to think, her hands tented beneath her chin. If I wanted to hide a key, she wondered, where would I put it? Nothing came to her. She sighed and reached for her high school photograph. She still couldn't believe her father had it, let alone kept it on his desk. Upon closer examination, she noticed the photo had shifted downward the tiniest bit, exposing the top edge of what looked like another picture behind it. She turned the frame over and, using her fingernail, bent open the metal points used to hold the mat in place, then took out the mat and a thin piece of cardboard between it and the picture. As suspected, there was another photo behind the first. It took her a few seconds to realize who it was, but when she did, her eyes went wide. Mother smiled in the professional-looking portrait, wearing a crisp white blouse and a necklace with a silver cross. Her light hair was pushed back in a headband, the rest falling in soft waves over her shoulders. She couldn't have been any older than 18 or 20. Apparently, Mother hadn't always been opposed to pictures. Imagining her as a young woman had always been difficult for Julia, but here was proof that Coraline Blackwood had once been fresh, vibrant, and beautiful. Still, Julia had trouble connecting the wide, genuine smile of the woman in the picture with Mother. She had never seen her smile like that. What had changed? Was it the loss of her first daughter that turned her into the woman Julia remembered? Or was it the affair, or obsession, or whatever it was her husband had with the albino in the circus? And why had Father covered Mother's picture with hers? She laid both photos on the desk, mother and daughter side by side. The shape of their faces and their features were nearly identical. The arch of the brows, even the way one eye was the tiniest bit lower than the other. She had never noticed the similarities before, but now it seemed eerie how much they resembled each other. They could have been the same person living in separate eras. No matter how much Julia might have fantasized in the past about coming from a different family, there was no denying she was Coraline Blackwood's daughter. With a thousand questions running through her mind, she returned the pictures to the frame and started putting it back together. Then she stopped. A small key had been taped to the front of the cardboard behind Mother's photo. Her heartbeat picked up speed as she peeled off the key, removed the tape, and tried it in the locked drawer. It fit and turned. She held her breath and pulled open the drawer. A polished wooden box sat alone and perfectly centered in the bottom, in stark contrast to the chaos in the rest of the desk. With shaking hands, she carefully lifted the box and put it on the blotter, relieved to see it didn't have a lock. She opened the lid and found a velvet drawstring purse and a red leather camera case. She took out the drawstring purse and opened it. Inside was a pearl necklace, matching earrings, and a silver hairbrush wrapped in yellow newspaper. She stared at the white strands in the brush. It couldn't be, could it? She took out the camera case and set it on the desk. The clasp was broken, and the brittle leather felt like grit on her fingertips. Working gently, she took the camera out of the case. Written in blue ink inside the case lid was a name, Lily. Was that her father's mistress? If so, why did he have her things? A thin piece of folded cardboard sat on the bottom of the box. Julia took it out and unfolded it. Red and blue paint flecked off the creases of a poster from the Barlow Brothers Circus. On the front, two clowns smiled and waved next to a pale-looking elephant standing on its hind legs. A woman, dressed in a white evening gown, sat in the elephant's curled trunk, smiling with one arm in the air. It looked like the same woman from the newspaper clipping. Julia picked up the camera and turned it over in her hands. It was a silver and black enamel Kodak, with three round knobs on the top. Despite its age, it looked brand new. She released the lens, looked through the viewfinder, and pushed the exposure level. To her surprise, the camera clicked and the shutter closed. She wound the advance knob. The camera had film inside. The morning after finding the camera inside the locked drawer of her father's desk, Julia woke up with a splitting headache. That second glass of brandy was a bad idea. Then again, it wasn't every day you found out you had a dead sister and your father might have had an albino mistress. Not to mention wondering why your parents needed forgiveness for something to do with your sister's death, and putting your foot down about something you believed in. All those jumbled up emotions felt like having the stomach flu, complete with trembling knees and the desire to throw up. If being the owner of Blackwood Manor Horse Farm was going to be this draining, maybe she wasn't cut out for the job. The leaden sky outside her window mirrored her frame of mind. Rain clouds hung like gray waves above the treetops, as if ready to break open and flood the earth at any second. If it were up to her, she would have stayed in bed all day. But there were too many things to do, too many things to figure out and untangle. She crawled out from under her warm covers, got washed and dressed, and went downstairs. After a quick cup of tea, she put the camera and case from her father's desk in her purse, threw on a coat and hat, and went out the mudroom door toward the barn. Hopefully, Claude would still give her a ride somewhere, no matter how mad he was about retrieving the nurse mare foal. The thought of riding alone with him for any length of time sounded as appealing as chewing sawdust, but how else would she get into town? Besides, she wanted to ask him 100 questions, including if he knew anything about the camera. If they were in the truck together, he wouldn't be able to walk away. When she was halfway across the lawn, Fletcher came out of the barn and ambled toward her, smiling. How could he be so cheerful on this crappy day? She wondered. When he reached her, she forced a smile and kept walking. He stopped and turned. Hey!
Morning,
she said.
He followed her. I was coming over to the house to see you.
Why? What do you need?
I want to show you something.
Without looking at him, she knew he was grinning. She could hear the smile in his voice. What is it with him anyway? Why is he always so happy? It's annoying.
What? She asked. Come over to my truck and see.
Can it wait? I have errands to run in town, and I need to ask Claude for a ride.
It'll only take a second, he said. Besides, you're the boss around here, and I need your okay. Just give it a quick look, and I'll run you into town after.
She stopped and looked at him, sighing. Riding into town with him would be a lot better than riding with Claude, and she wasn't really in the mood to ask Claude questions anyway. If he was mean and rude, she might say something she'd regret. Maybe by the time they got back, she'd feel braver and have a better outlook.
Okay, what do you want to show me?
Fletcher's smile widened.
Great, he said. Follow me.
He led her across the lawn toward a horse trailer hitched to his truck. On the way, they passed Claude fixing a gate near the barn driveway. He glanced up at them, then put his head back down, his eyes on his work. Julia clenched her jaw, a knot of dread twisting in her stomach. In her head, she was tough, but in reality, she hated the thought of anyone being angry at her, even someone as ornery as Claude. And if he was still upset about the foals, he might not be willing to talk about anything. She trailed Fletcher along the side of the horse trailer and followed him around to the back, wishing they could get this over with so she could go into town and find a place to get the film and the camera developed. Maybe the pictures would help answer some of her questions. Fletcher unlocked the ramp and let it down, then gestured for her to follow him up it. He was still smiling, but there was a strange tightness in his eyes, a rare glint of unease she had never seen before. Normally, he seemed to swagger around the barn like the jocks who used to make fun of her in school, sure of the world around him and his place in it. Seeing him like this made her nervous. She didn't think she could handle any more surprises. Steeling herself, she went up the ramp, peered inside the trailer, and gasped. Lying in a bed of yellow straw, a newborn foal, the color of coal, lifted its head and blinked up at her. When it saw her and Fletcher, it struggled to its feet on wobbly legs and pushed its tiny muzzle over the door. Julia smiled and rubbed its fuzzy forehead, forgetting about Claude, her late sister, and the film in the camera.
Is this the nurse mare's foal?
She said.
I thought Claude brought it back last night.
He did, Fletcher said. This one was born over at the Thompson farm early this morning. The mare rejected it.
She frowned.
How come?
He shrugged. Sometimes it just happens. No one knows why. It was the mare's first.
She looked at the orphan foal's sweet face and felt an instant kinship with it, immediately berating herself for being so caught up in her own problems she almost refused to listen to Fletcher.
But how will it survive without its mother?
He leaned over the door and scratched the foal's neck. I was hoping you'd take care of it.
Her eyes went wide.
Me? I don't know anything about...
I'll help you.
I don't know, she said. I might do something wrong. Then it will get sick, and I've got so much to do in the house, and...
After what you did yesterday, telling Claude not to take any more foals from their mares, I figured you wouldn't mind me bringing this little one here. It was either that or the auction, and its chances of survival after that wouldn't be good.
She took a deep breath and gazed at the newborn. She had no idea what was involved in taking care of a foal, but she couldn't turn away this beautiful baby and send it to auction. She looked at Fletcher.
What about you? Why can't you take care of it?
I'm on the road every day. A newborn needs to be fed about every 2 hours for the first week, then every 4 to 6 hours after that.
She gaped at him. For how long?
After a few weeks, she'll show interest in solid food, but you'll still have to bottle feed her for a while.
She?
Yes, it's a filly.
She studied the filly's innocent, trusting eyes. There was no other choice. She had to take the poor thing in.
Okay, she said.
Okay what?
I'll take care of her.
Fletcher grinned and unhitched the trailer door.
Great. Let's get her in the barn.
I picked up some fresh cow's milk on the way here, but it has to be watered down a bit.
She feigned surprise.
You already picked up milk? What if I had said no?
He winked at her.
I knew you wouldn't. The filly backed away from the opening doorway, frightened by the strange sights and sounds. Julia stepped off the ramp to get out of the way, while Fletcher went into the trailer and rubbed the filly's neck and ears and sides. At first, the filly wasn't sure what was going on, but the more Fletcher rubbed, the more she leaned into him, like a dog enjoying a scratch. Eventually, Fletcher straightened, clicked his tongue, and exited the trailer. The filly followed him, down the ramp on spindly, wobbly legs, then bounded behind him toward the barn, her short, fuzzy tail held high. Julia followed, and Claude turned to watch them go by, a scowl on his face. She forced a smile and waved at him. He nodded once, then went back to work. Halfway to the barn, the filly stopped, looked back at Julia, and waited for her to catch up. When she did, the filly jumped and kicked a hind leg in the air, as if happy she was there. She stayed beside Julia as they followed Fletcher into the barn, and Julia's eyes grew moist. Maybe she was imagining things, but it seemed like the little horse already loved her. Julia left her purse in the barn office and went to help Fletcher put the filly in an empty stall. He filled a bottle with watered-down milk and showed Julia how to hold it, then watched her feed the newborn, his hands on his hips, a satisfied look on his face. Julia grinned like a fool as the filly slurped and licked and tugged on the nipple.
You're a natural, Fletcher said.
You think so?
Sure, she took right to you.
Claude came over to the stall and peered over the door.
What's this all about?
I brought this filly over from the Thompson farm, Fletcher said.
The mare rejected it.
So now we're taking in culls? Claude said, his voice hard.
She took a liking to Julia, Fletcher said.
Claude shook his head and walked away, mumbling under his breath. Julia looked up at Fletcher, her eyebrows raised.
Don't worry, he said. He'll get over it.
I don't know. First I said I don't want foals taken from mares, and now this? I'm afraid we might never get along.
He just doesn't like change, he said.
Your mother, sorry, I mean Mrs. Blackwood, even said it took a while for him to listen to her after your father died. And now you're in charge after he's been running the show on his own for a while. He's a little hard around the edges and set in his ways, but he'll come around.
She studied Fletcher's face, trying to imagine him having a heart-to-heart with Mother.
Maybe he knew more about Blackwood Manor and her parents than she thought.
Did my mother confide in you often?
He laughed.
No. It was more like her yelling and swearing at Claude for not listening.
That sounds more like the Mrs. Blackwood I remember, she grinned.
Do you think it will help if I swear it, Claude?
He laughed again. No, you're doing a good job at keeping a balance between respecting his expertise and letting him know you're the